Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Fun Man About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izett.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I am really excited about today's show, but before we dive into it, there are some local things happening that we would like to speak to. First of all, congratulations to Finback. They just celebrated their three-year anniversary, had quite an affair on Saturday.
Saturday.
They go so fast, yes. Saturday, and Mary and I went as a crazy cat couple because the owners are crazy cat lovers, and I say this because one reason we started this show, maybe perhaps a couple seconds late today, not that anybody listens to this live, is because Mary just found out that the crazy cat...
The amazing acrocats
are coming to town to New York. So that's worthy of mention, regardless of where you fall on
the cat scale.
The cat scale as a fermenter. Most fermenters are animal lovers to some degree, I would argue.
Yes. And I will say,
some sort of animal. Right?
After we celebrated at Finback, we headed with our friends to the Queens International.
Yeah. Night market.
Night market, yes. Man, I am. My brain's not working. Anyway.
It's a rainy
day here.
Market day's called day.
Yes. But the Queens International Night Market is back. It's on Saturday night throughout the summer, and I cannot recommend it enough. There were fermented foods there, but other highlights include.
Did they have balut this year? Did you find?
They did.
You found it.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't have any.
Not this time.
Nope. That's but it. They
is
do
that
have
fermented
it.
Or it's just preserved?
No.
How do you define preserved and fermenting when it comes to
neither? I mean, it's
I have developed eggs.
Yes, it's just regular
baby
cooked
chicken
food.
Or
yeah,
bird.
But I did have a cricket tamale, which was excellent, actually. So I would recommend that. And I'm a flexitarian, so I had beef heart on a skewer as well, and that was also very delicious. And then I did have a vegetarian Persian rice dish. And that was it. We were pretty full, I guess, after that. But man, they have fried ice cream and all kinds of good stuff. There was so much more that I wanted
to
have.
There are at least 150 different languages spoken in Queens. Queens is one of the most diverse boroughs that we have.
And one of the most diverse places in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. It's insane. And so all seeing that come together behind the Science Museum was pretty it. Speaking of anniversaries, Big Alice is having their anniversary on June 11th. It's their four-year anniversary, and they're having a party from noon to 8 p.m., and I'll be playing with the home musicians that evening at 5 p.m. We're excited getting another set together and even a little bit of new material that I'm excited about.
Savor is in D.C. on June 2nd and 3rd. Chris will be going on Saturday day. I'm doing some sewing here in New York City. I'm sorry to miss it, but there are still tickets left. SavorCraftBeer.com.
Rachel, is Cheryl doing a thing tomorrow?
It looks like it on Facebook. It says that Contraband Ferments is doing a workshop tomorrow at Bitter and Esters. So go on to BitterandEsters.com to take a look at that.
Speaking of BitterandEsters.com, John LaPaula and I are hooking up an event at Fifth Hammer. We are not open yet. We're very close. We should be getting our certificate of occupancy, hopefully, knock on wood, maybe in June. That would be awesome. Probably not making beer until July, but I'll update people as we get along there. But we better be open by August 19th because we're going to celebrate with Stan Hieronymus, who's visiting from out of town, to talk foraging and brewing with alternate ingredients. And ahead of that, finally, we've talked about Steve Brill before, but they call him Wild Man Steve Brill, and he goes to Prospect Park, Central Park, and he forages right here in the city limits for edible ingredients, mushrooms, spices, and things of the like. And we're going to try and get a crew of people together of homebrewers that want to join us on a walk, probably July 9th, to forage local New York City state ingredients that they might be able to brew for and have a bottle share when Stan comes to town celebrating his recent book.
Yeah, so if you're listening to this, we're going to be reaching out to local homebrewers. But if you're listening to this and you want to be involved, please send us a message.
And how do we send us a message?
Fermentaboutit@gmail.com.
And check out bitterdesters.com.
Or through Facebook or whatever.
Or Twitter, too. All the same.
Mary, how was last week?
Last week was crazy. Amazing crazy.
And we're talking specifically to...
So I participated in the first annual Taste NY craft beer competition, which was a New York State beer competition that was started by the governor and his office. So Governor Andrew Cuomo, many of you have heard of him. I am sure he's a very high-profile governor. He has been a huge supporter of the craft beer industry in New York State. New York State is currently ranked, I think, number 5 in economic impact.
About over
$4 billion economic impact. And we've gone from... How many? I got to look at my notes.
It was 90
again.
In 2011 to 326 breweries now.
Yeah,
today.
So pretty amazing growth here in New York State, including New York City.
Especially in New York City, yeah.
Yep. Anyway, so it was the first annual Taste New York craft beer competition. It was open to pretty much any brewery that wanted to sign up. Mm-hmm. There was voting online, and the five breweries were chosen by public vote to go on. Each of those breweries was allowed to choose a beer to enter into the competition, and then a judging panel was created. I, being a national beer judge and beer writer, co-host, etc., was I feel very, very fortunate to have been chosen by this panel.
Garrett Oliver put it together, right?
Yeah. Well, he helped, yeah. And he did recommend me, which thank you, Garrett. This was an amazing opportunity. I had a great time, and it was super cool. So I got to judge beer with Governor Cuomo, Mario Batali, Thurman Thomas.
Ann Becerra.
Aaron likes beer. And then a couple guys from Bon Appetit and Food & Wine Magazine. So it was pretty amazing. That was definitely the most interesting and highest profile beer competition I expect to ever judge in my life. I mean, everybody was nice, man.
Yeah.
It was super cool. I will say Mario Batali I've never met him before. He was very nice. And he's actually pretty into beer. And
it was kind of insane.
It
was speed judging. It was judging in front of people. Everybody got to watch you guys judge. And
in a long table on a long elevated table in front of this room full of people, including the breweries that were entered into the competition.
Right.
So anyway, it was really cool. It was good to see five really good beers go up against each other. Very different styles. I got to say, every beer that we tasted was good, but congratulations to the winner, which is Roscoe Beer Company and Omegang.
Ty.
Yep.
Pretty crazy.
So it's super cool. It's very exciting to have seen the craft beer growth in New York State. When I started writing for Ale Street in 2006 or 2007, and I didn't even have enough breweries for my column. So to see this much happening and to be a part of this as Chris is opening Fifth Hammer, it's a super cool thing to have experienced the growth and all the camaraderie and this amazing community that we have and to be going forward as an actual part of it.
Hear, hear. And that community and that growth is national. So today's show, I'm incredibly tickled to have this show because I am not just a podcast host. I'm a podcast listener. And I'm really excited about today's show because it's hosts on hosts on hosts. And today we have Jake Goodwin, host of the Sour Hour on thebrewingnetwork.com. And also he's the co-founder and director of blending and brewing operations at the Rare Barrel. Jay, he's fallen asleep at his desk. No, he's still there.
Sorry, we had a lot of announcements, but welcome to the show.
Thanks. Long time, first time. Big fan of you guys.
That is mutual, absolutely. I've learned so much from you and your show, and you've been a great inspiration with what you do at the Rare Barrel. But our listeners are not all beer people, so we're going to start at the beginning and on who you are. We'd like to know, who is Jake Goodwin? How did this beer journey start? And where did we get from there to now?
Sure, yeah. I'm Jay. I went to college, and that's where I fell in love with drinking beer. One of the other co-founders here at the Rare Barrel is Alex. Alex was my roommate senior year, and he's the one who actually started home brewing. I would assist him in sanitizing and bottling. It's probably why our first batches didn't turn out that well, because I was in charge of that. But, we were hooked, and Alex had a biology background, and I was studying psychology, but we were also taking these like entrepreneurship classes down in Santa Barbara, and every class we took, we kind of used the same project of starting a brewery. So that was our starting a business project, and by the end of it, we were just like, hey, maybe we should actually make a go of this. And our plan was for Alex to be the brewer, since he had the biology background, and I would find, I don't know, some way to contribute with my psychology education and no practical work experience. But shortly after we graduated, we kind of found that the opposite had happened. So Alex got a job in sales, which ended up being really valuable, and I got a job at a then very small brewery in Placentia, California, called The Brewery, which some of your more craft beer-focused listeners will know. And, yeah, they were just starting, and just asked for kind of like a foot in the door with them. You know, I emailed Patrick and Tyler and offered to sweep the floors, you know, work for minimum wage, whatever hours they had available. You know, I just wanted to work there. Luckily for me, the following Tuesday after I emailed them, they had what was then their biggest batch they were ever going to bottle up to that point. And they were like, yeah, let's get this guy in. You know, it's probably not going to work out because bottling's not fun and going to be a long day. So they told me later on that they thought I would never be back after that first day. But I spent a full 4 years there. I learned a whole lot from them. And that's really where I fell in love with sour beer, which is what we're doing now at the Rare Barrel.
Mm-hmm. When you were there, were you there when Doug Constantino was there as well?
Yeah, there was a point in time. This is probably the most fun I've had in brewing, which is when Travis Smith, formerly of Russian River, was there, and Doug joined the team as well. Travis and Doug split off eventually to form Society Brewing Company, a terrific brewery in San Diego. And then I left to do the Rare Barrel. But we, once a year during San Francisco Beer Week, which is in early February, we'll get everyone back together for an event here at the Rare Barrel, which we call the Reunion. And we serve all of our beers together. It's really just an excuse for us to hang out and reminisce about old times, but really, it's great to be associated with such good breweries.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. Doug is an old friend of ours from the New York City Home Brewers Guild, and he left us to go to the brewery, or to go out west, and that's when you guys crossed paths. So the Rare Barrel, how old is the Rare Barrel?
We're about 3.5 years old. I always have trouble with that question because, you know, we had a lot of long time before we actually decided to do this and when we actually started selling beer. I think I quit at the brewery early in 2012. By the end of the year, we had found our space, and then it took us about 4 to 6 months to do our construction project and get licensed. Then we started to brew in February-ish, and we didn't sell our first beer. We didn't open our tasting room until 2 days after Christmas, 2013. Mm-hmm. So it was a long, long process, longer than even a typical brewery. Chris, I heard you talking about your brewery coming up, and I wish you all the luck in the world. This is the hard part. But just keep your chin up and wish for the best. But yeah, it was a pretty long process for us.
And you guys, in particular, because of what you're doing at the Rare Barrel and how it works, tell us about how that. Well, was the concept that you have for the Rare Barrel what you wanted from the beginning? Or how did that develop?
Yeah, I mean, from the beginning, we wanted to only make sour beer. So, you know, sour beer, especially the type we make here, which is barrel-aged sour beer, is a very long process. I mean, at the fastest turnaround time is probably around 6 months or so, from brew day to through bottling and selling the beer. But it can take much, much longer. There are some types of this beer that take up to 3 years to make and blend. Most of our beers average around about a year to go from brew day to bottling, so it is a pretty unique process.
That is a long, you have a lot of patience, I gotta say. So when I met Mary, she was only doing sour beers and fun stuff, and she had a basement full of stuff that she'd been sitting on so long. And then here we are today, now we're doing nothing but speed brewing because New York has, we have no time for anything else, just at the house. But a lot of our listeners too, we deal with a lot of just other fermentations that don't take that long. Why do these ferments take so long to get to where they're drinkable or where you want them?
Yeah, basically it's because you're making beer with stuff that doesn't want to make beer. So we're using wild yeast and bacteria, which, you know, is obviously pretty common across a lot of the things you talk about on your show. But, these yeast and bacteria do not want to make beer. They don't want to ferment sugar. They want to create a lot of off flavors. But if you can navigate that and kind of set them up for success along the way, then you can really make something that transcends what a beer can be. I mean, you know, you guys talk about fermented flavors across the board, and I think if people are listening to this, they're fans of, you know, complex flavors, interesting flavors, and aromas that are derived from yeast and bacteria, and that's what sour beer is. It's definitely on the most complex end of the beer style spectrum, but it's also extremely hard to produce, which is why, I mean, 5 years ago, not that many people were making this style. Now it's become a lot more popular. Some people are able to do it a little bit faster. There's different types of sour beer, but the one we stick with is this slow barrel-aged sour beer.
I'm going to ask, what are some of your favorite bugs and materials to work with? Your personal favorites. I know that's a hard question to answer, but just going to put it out there.
That's a good question. We've been working a lot with saison yeast in the recent months. So, you know, I just was talking about how sour beer needs wild yeast and bacteria. Doesn't mean you can't incorporate Saccharomyces brewer's yeast into the mix. And we've been doing a lot of experimenting with a bunch of different saison strains. It seems like there's like an unlimited amount of saison yeast strains out there available from the larger yeast labs, and also there's a lot of smaller yeast labs popping up all the time doing very specialty blends or strains that they've isolated from different sources, so that's something we'll play around with quite a bit. But I'm also interested in the interaction with Brettanomyces. I think that's really how you get a really distinct aroma that makes sour beer so different. You can get acidity in a lot of different beverages and foods, but there's something about the way a sour beer smells from the Brettanomyces fermentation. Some people, I mean, the descriptors are all over the board. Everyone has trouble describing what they're smelling. There's this intriguing, alluring thing that doesn't really smell like anything else, which is probably why people are. It's not that easy to describe. Some people use funky. Some people use, you know, barnyard, horse blanket, weird stuff, mousy. It's just all the things that don't sound very good. But then when you smell the beer, I think it's just incredibly intriguing, and it's unlike really any other product that's out there. So that's what I've been interested in most recently.
Awesome. That makes me think. I do a lot of reading about kind of the physiology of flavor and tasting and aroma and all that stuff. And I guess that because that is something interesting that I've thought about is how do we describe, you know, Brett and some of these the aromas and flavors that we get from Brett fermentation or mixed fermentation. And I think a lot of it, maybe the reason we have a hard time is because we don't have anything in our memory bank. Like, most of us haven't come across those exact smells, so we've never encountered them before. Or we haven't encountered them in that way. Anyway, it would be interesting to look into a little bit more. Then I'm also interested in your material. So you guys use a lot of interesting stuff. You have a couple beers with rose petals, some white tea, coriander. What are some of your favorite materials that you've, or something that you've been surprised by maybe too?
Oh, wow. There's always surprises, but they're usually not good surprises in sour beer. You know, we've worked with a lot of interesting ingredients. one of our recent combinations was kind of like a Goza-style beer, except it was barrel-aged for a long time, so it's not really a Goza at all. But it uses sea salt and coriander, and that's got a nice light acidity to it and a nice Brett character. That beer is called Across the Sea, and that's been a staff favorite that we just came out with. The one thing I found is that a lot of the things that work really well in sour beer when it comes to spices or things you wouldn't really necessarily always associate with beer is anything tea-related works really well with sour beer. So we've done hibiscus, we've done a lot of citrus, we've done a lot of we've done hibiscus and different flowers. So just having that floral aromatic with kind of an acid component, I think, makes it really nice. Ginger, too. Ginger was really good.
In a recent episode, you talked a little bit about how much your attitude towards hops have been changing a little bit, or IBUs.
Yeah, that's been a big factor for us. It's kind of a dual purpose. So the hoppier we can make our wort, the more bitter we can make it, the more we can inhibit the bacteria to not produce too much acid, which has been a problem for us. We really grew up our bacteria to be very strong and produce acid quickly, but we wanted to have the option to restrain it and have it develop much later in the fermentation. So we've been using hops for that purpose quite a bit lately. But I think it's also driving a lot of new aromatics. There's a lot of interactions that'll happen between our primary yeast and fermentation with hops versus without hops that is creating aromas that we were not getting before. So there's kind of, it's not just a bitterness factor, but it's also we're creating new compounds from our fermentation by amping up the hop variety. And something we're looking forward to researching and using more going forward is aged hops, which is traditional for a lot of Belgian-style sour beers, like Lambic and Goose. But more and more American brewers are using these, not just to replicate those styles, but also in beers that maybe don't age quite as long as those. Those are the ones that will be more the over a year, up to 3 year beers, the Belgian, Lambic, and Goose. But, you know, we're Americans. We borrow and steal things from other cultures and repurpose them, relabel them, so I think this is just another good example of that, and we're trying to find out how much of those beers' flavor and aroma is contributed by these aged hops. So that's been something we've been looking into quite a bit lately.
Cool. Well, we are going to take a very short break, and we'll be right back with more from Jay Goodwin.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods' slogan, Eat 'em to Save 'em, was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Welcome back to Ferment About It. We are here in the studio on May 22nd, 2017, with Jay Goodwin of the Rare Barrel and the Sour Hour on the line. We are talking all things mixed fermentation and what all things conceptual from the rare barrel. And Mary has a follow-up question.
Yeah, so I know I always think of like hops inhibiting growth of lactobacillus, but is that also true for acetobacter and something like PDO?
You know, I'm not sure about acetobacter. That's something we try to just keep out of our fermentations altogether.
Yep.
I think it will slow down PDO and acetobacter, but those are still both going to, they have much higher hop tolerances. Even there are even lactobacillus strains that are themselves hop tolerant, but sometimes it's just about knocking them back, preventing them from fully achieving their goal of fermenting the sugar into acid. And instead, maybe some of the brewer's yeast, maybe some of the Brettanomyces wild yeast can continue to work on these sugars and make sure there's not as much food for the bacteria. And that can kind of guide where the flavor of beer goes, the aromatics as well, but also what the acidity balance is going to be for a beer like that. So it's been successful so far. We're also using a lot of different barrel treatment techniques. We're basically trying to clean out the barrel really well to make sure that any cultures that might carry over from batch to batch are not influencing the next beer. That's been relatively successful as well. But there are also times where we just want to let things go a little wild. It just depends on what our balance of beers are in the cellar, also what we're trying to accomplish with our experiment.
So I know that there are not, you had mentioned not only there are a lot more companies that are smaller companies, particularly that are producing cultures of yeast and bacteria, but there's also a lot more work being done, you know, genetically finding, you know, kind of finding and identifying all kinds of strains of both sac and Brett and lacto and you name it. How has that influenced what you guys are doing? Has it had an impact?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I mean, it's great to have that hard work outsourced because while we are starting our lab program, our quality program here in the last 6 months, we don't have all the infrastructure to isolate a bunch of Brettanomyces, for example, evaluate them in a fermentation, and then try to propagate them into, you know, commercial use. But there are a lot of small yeast labs all around the country and really all around the world that are starting to get more into this, whereas the big yeast labs are doing some of that as well, but they're more into supplying larger breweries or with brewer's yeast and the stuff that people reorder all the time. This is kind of the new frontier, and I was at a craft brewers conference, and that's where I saw Chris. And one of the lectures I went to, they had mentioned that, you know, in the last 10 years, maybe the most important job in the brewing industry has been hop chemists and hop researchers. But really, for me, I think the next 10 years is going to be all about microbiologists, because so much of the flavor of beer, and definitely of sour beer, comes from the wild yeast and bacteria, and there's so much we don't know about it. So while people are starting to look into this, we're still just at the beginning of this journey, which really makes it a really special time in sour beer, where there's a lot of knowledge being shared, there's a lot of research, and just a great time to be a part of this movement.
Speaking of knowledge being shared, one of the recent things that you talked about is developing a low pH-tolerant bottle conditioning yeast and how to get there as a home brewer. Could you touch upon that and why you would want to do so?
Yeah, so that's a good example. I think that's something where, you know, someone with a micro background can really look into this, and it'll provide a direct benefit for sour beer. Sour beers are notoriously difficult to bottle well and bottle condition well. So bottle conditioning is the re-fermentation inside of a bottle that'll produce the carbonation for the beer. But as opposed to a regular beer, which is at a little higher pH, the sour beer has a lot of acid content. And typically, the yeast you're going to use for bottle conditioning are not well suited for that environment. In fact, we use a Saccharomyces yeast here for our bottle conditioning, and we have to go through a whole process that limits what's called terminal acid shock, and we basically slowly introduce it. We temper it into a more acidic environment, and then it's able to be used for our bottling. Even then, it doesn't always go 100% well. So Brettanomyces yeast are naturally able to survive at lower pHs, so they have a higher acid tolerance. So if you're ever going to re-ferment in a bottle with Brettanomyces, you know, why not be selecting for the yeast that are active during bottle re-fermentation, and then selecting those the colonies or the single cells, and then growing those up to continue to use, because they've proven successful in a previous low pH environment. And that's, you know, a lot of people think about capturing wild yeast and all this stuff, and, you know, oh, there's a unique strain, I caught this off of a flower growing in my backyard, or there's a Brettanomyces on this peach tree or in this vineyard. But really, what I think is that that's a very romantic and nice, you know, avenue to go down. But at the same time, I feel like just the yeast that we already have going through, that we know can ferment beer, going through their just natural mutation process is going to be yield a lot faster results and ultimately even be a lot more interesting. I mean, you just think about Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is, you know, the brewer's ale yeast, and then how many variants there are on that. Mm-hmm. The same thing can happen with Brettanomyces bruxellensis. You know, why can't there be 150 mutations of that strain that perform differently in all these different scenarios? So that's kind of where I've been thinking about, you know what, it doesn't take a pro brewer, it doesn't even take a microbiologist to do this. Home brewers can do a lot of this work on their own by just selecting the best yeast that they can, you know, top cropping or however you want to do it, but and then just applying those forward, keeping them alive, keeping the viable ones going that can survive in this very harsh environment.
Yep. Just keep taking them from places where they're live and things are sour and low pH. Keep propping it up.
Yeah. Survival of the fittest.
Drink a little, save a little from a bottle conditioned bottle.
I agree completely.
So the Sour Hour, man, I am a huge fan, and I started listening to the Sour Hour a couple years ago when I was kind of inherited all these barrels that were at this brewery that I was working at. I started working at Greenpoint Beer Works, and we had a bunch of barrels that had been neglected for a very long time. And some of the things we just talked about, you know, the Acetobacter that was in there and just barrel blending. I was charged with blending some of these and figuring out what to do with these barrels. I immediately started listening to the Sour Hour and getting into it. And there's been so much great knowledge bequeathed from it. How did the Sour Hour come about? And tell us about this journey a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We went on another Brewing Network show called The Session. Alex and I were just representing the Rare Barrel. And we had discussed beforehand, you know, this idea of maybe doing a sour-only podcast. And we're like, oh, yeah, you know, if this goes well, we should bring it up to them and see what they think. And then when we were on the show, they brought it up that we should do that. And at that point, I was just like, yes, okay, let's do that. And that was just kind of live on the air. And, you know, I followed up and I was like, you know, just to let you guys know, I'm serious about this. And there was mutual interest from the beginning. Although sour beer information is getting a lot more accessible, in, you know, 3-5 years ago, it was very hard. I remember when I was working at the brewery trying to just collect all the information I could out there. I mean, reading Wild Brews by Jeff Sparrow cover to cover several times over, and even going to the references section and then reading all the references he pulled out over and over, and it's like, yep, that's pretty much it. I mean, if you wanted to get good advice on how to make a beer sour, you could read a regular brewing textbook that talked about how to avoid infection and then just flip all of that advice, basically. So there wasn't a lot. So I was really passionate on this knowledge sharing part of the sour beer community. I really want everyone's sour beer to be better. That's good for me. That's good for everyone. I like to drink good sour beer. Bad sour beer tastes terrible.
Pretty bad,
the more good sour beer, the more good sour beer out there, the better it is for a brewery like mine that only makes sour beer. So, and then all of a sudden, there were a lot of good resources. So Mike Tonsmeyer's American Sour Beers book came out. Milk the Funk, which I'll put a plug in there for, which is a website, a wiki, a Facebook group, check them out. And then someone who actually ended up sponsoring our show, Sour Beer Blog, is a great deep dive into a lot of really good sour beer topics. But yeah, Sour Hour is nice because we can get some of the best sour beer makers all over the world on the show and then just have a long conversation about all their philosophies, what makes their brewery unique. And it's really gotten a lot of the commercial techniques, the thoughts, the theories out there. But, you know, it's also not definitive. All of this is very much in development. So I think that's what that kind of contributes to the popularity of the show a little bit, is that we're bringing up a lot of ideas for everyone to discuss. We're not saying this is the absolute way you need to be doing this. It's just like, this is how this brewery does it. And then we get another brewery who makes the same type of beer, and they make it totally different, and their beer is just as good. Right. So it kind of just brings up these ideas for everyone to discuss, and it's been a lot of fun.
That's what keeps the whole category really intriguing, the unpredictability of what's going on with how you treat Brett and everybody's different approach to what to do in that area.
Absolutely, yeah. And we at the Rare Barrel, you know, there's my role as the host, but I'm also, you know, fishing for information for myself. It's like, I'll definitely be asking questions that are geared towards what we're working on at the Rare Barrel at the time, and it's an awesome resource for me too. I mean, I've said it on the show multiple times, but I listen to the show too. I really like it because I mean, it's a lot of the guests. I throw in a few comments here or there, but all these people are really good at what they do. They're passionate, and they're also willing to share their information. So it's been awesome.
Mm-hmm. Are there any like kind of really shocking or like really enlightening tips that you've gotten while on the show that you can recall at the moment?
You know, there have, but they're all, it's almost too many to remember. Yeah. It's, I'll just take an example from one of the early shows, though. We had our show where Troy Casey of Casey Brewing and Blending was our guest. Mm-hmm. And it's actually convenient that I picked this episode because he had a lot of different ways to treat oak barrels and make his beer, and he's fermenting in oak while we're fermenting in stainless. There was a lot of divergence between what he was doing at Casey Brewing and Blending and what we were doing at the Rare Barrel. And Troy's beers are out of this world great and really sought after. If you ever see him out there, definitely check him out. But that was a great way to, you know, show that there can be, you know, solid beers made by two different methods. And then it just so happened on that same show, a brewer from out of town was visiting us. It was Chris Johnson from Green Bench Brewing in Tampa. And he kind of went over his kettle souring method, which for those who kettle sour or maybe even have a commercial brewery or just have this much equipment to be able to do this on the homebrew level, but during his whirlpool, he would recirculate through his sintered stone that you usually use for oxygen. He used carbon dioxide, and that was in an effort to dissolve CO2 into the wort and protect it from oxygen, which is a real key when you're going to be making kettle sour beers. And his beers were very clean and drinkable, and we've gotten a lot of good feedback on just bringing up that technique. Now, a lot of people do that, and it's just pretty cool that, you know, someone just dropped by and said, this is how I do it, and now, you know, 50, 100 other brewers adopt that as one of their practices. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I did particularly love that show. It was a good one. And I had never met Chris until this latest CBC, much like you. I was hanging out at Ben's Chili Bowl late at night, and there's Jeff Stuffings and Chris Johnson. And I was like, yeah, dude, I love you guys, too. Kind of the same bro crush when I met you, what happened there at Ben's Chili Bowl.
That's awesome. Yeah, those two are always seen together, so I'm not
I would be remiss not to ask your favorite answers to the question that you ask at the end of your show, which is what are the biggest mistakes in sour beer making, and do you ask of your guests? What are some of the common themes that your guests have answered here, and or some of your favorite answers?
Yeah, that's I like that question. It might be, you know, ending on a little bit of a negative vibe. I don't know. Maybe that's a mistake. And I'm not that great of a host. I just like talking about beer. But
we don't know what we're doing either. Nobody listens to these things anyway. Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah, some of the common answers, I think, or just the themes that come up is that, you know, sour doesn't always mean good, or sour doesn't always mean complex. I think complexity is a blanket term that sometimes will cover up some off flavors, you know, like cheese and feet and nail polish, and some of this stuff is like, I don't know if you can say that's complex, it's just bad. You know?
Right, like, right, right.
Complex can be complex bad, or it can be complex good. So you have to really like the yep. flavors. A few others are just that, you know, if you don't like your sour beer, just dump it. That's been a big piece of advice across a lot of the shows. And then some more controversial ones, like some people saying they're completely against kettle sours, which is a controversial topic in sour beer making. For those who don't know, kettle sours they kind of differs from the process I was outlining. That what we do at the Rare Barrel, it's kind of a hot lactic acid fermentation in your kettle, and it can take anywhere from 1 to 3 days to achieve your acidity. You cool it back down, and then you ferment it like a regular beer. That process is very effective when done right, but there's just a lot of ways to do it wrong, and it's one of the beers with the rise in popularity of sour beer. It's an easy way to get in the sour beer game for a commercial brewery, and you see a lot of people doing that, but maybe all the techniques aren't totally solid yet, so you did get quite a bit of off flavors there. But I kind of disagree with the death to kettle sours movement, because I like to drink Berliner Weiss, I like to drink Goza, and I think Americans can make beers based off of this technique in a really nice way. We just got to be careful about defining what is a sour beer off flavor, because it's not that well understood how they form or even what they taste like.
Completely agree there.
Yep. Absolutely. And those kind of flavors aren't necessarily commonly taught either as far as in like off flavor classes. I think not yet. I think we're getting there. So we would be remiss to ask about, do you ferment anything else besides beer?
Yes. Yeah. This is kind of what drew me to your guys' show, actually, is that, you know, I like to, you know, at the long day of fermenting here at the Rare Barrel, go home, kick back, and do some other fermentations. So, you know, I got into sourdough bread making. I've been making kombucha, and also been making a lot of hot sauce. I'm happy there's no yearly limit, like
there's for beer, for home beer.
I might be over the hot sauce gallon.
Well, that's awesome. With all your barrel experience, are you doing any of these in a barrel? Are you doing any hot sauce in a barrel? Or at least oak, maybe even throwing some oak in there?
You know, I haven't done that yet. If I ever scaled up, you know, maybe that would be the way to go. But I did try to do kombucha in an oak barrel, and it did not go very well. I realized that there's some issues with mold and the surface not being totally covered. It was kind of like a heads-up oak barrel. And now I've switched over. I've commandeered one of our smaller stainless steel tanks at the brewery, and now I'm looking at it right now. It's in my office. It's nice. About 20 gallons of kombucha in there.
What are some of your favorite peppers to use in hot sauces?
Oh, wow. Any new ones I can find, I think. That's kind of my big... I'm such a home brewer when it comes to this stuff. It's like I made the standard, like, okay, here's my jalapeno hot sauce, and I was like, okay, that was good. I know how to do this now. Let's get the craziest peppers in the world. So I got, you know, like
step
scorpion,
one
Carolina Reaper, ghost chili. So I made a hot sauce with those three. But then I think the fun part about it is you can get peppers as hot or as mild as you want. And I kind of do this blending step with vinegar at the end and then kind of reconstitute the hot sauce. And you can just make it taste exactly as spicy as you want, which is pretty cool. That's something that I would never do in sour beer. It's kind of like, oh, should I add water to this beer to make it less sour? So I really enjoy that aspect of kombucha, bread, hot sauce, other things like that, because I don't always apply, like, the constraints of being, you know, this commercial sour beer producer to my other projects. Very, and I think it's what makes it relaxing in comparison to the day job.
Awesome. Did you... Did you read about this this Welsh farmer that accidentally created the hottest chili pepper recently?
No, but I'm going to have to get it.
You got to look it up. So, yeah, he entered it at he's entering, I guess, into the Chelsea Flower Show, and he accidentally created the hottest chili ever recorded. So it was intended to be, he was entering it as in the beauty category, I guess.
And
instead, yes, it measures a formidable 2.48 million on the Scoville heat scale, ahead of the 2.2 million achieved by the Carolina Reaper. Wow. Anyway, just going to dangle that out there.
Are you going to go for a taste competition for that, too? No. Mario Battaglia?
I have judged a chili sauce competition.
We still have hot sauce left over at our house from this thing, which is great.
Yeah, it was awesome, but that's, talk about palate fatigue. Whew.
Absolutely, yeah. I got to say, I don't think I answered your last question. I think habanero was the pepper that really got me into hot sauce, because although that's a very hot pepper, the flavor is so delicious that I just really wanted more of that flavor. And then when I kind of read more about how to, like, kind of dampen down the spicy factor of that, that's what got me hooked. I just love the taste of habanero. So that's the pepper that got me.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to go back and ask about rose petals, because I'm incredibly intrigued by the use of rose petals.
Yeah, we've done hibiscus flowers before. That's a little more common of a beer ingredient. But we have been doing a lot of trials with rose petals, and it's really interesting. You just get all sorts of flavors, not quite what you'd expect. So, I mean, even though there's roses in there, we've gotten some savory notes, some spicy notes, and we're just really looking.
Uh-oh. We may have lost Jay. His battery on his headset may have died. Hello. Last heard rose petals. Well, Mary, you don't get the end of that answer.
I'm left in suspense until I can get a hold of a bottle of one of these beers.
Sorry, we will do this again. Damn it, Jay. We love you, and thank you so much for joining us on Ferment About It. I'm so glad you're not here to have the last word so we can have it. But anyway, go to therarebarrel.com to find out more information about the Rare Barrel. We don't get the Rare Barrel here in New York City, although Mary and I did have a chance of tasting it on Saturday.
We tasted the Impossible Soul, which was delicious.
Freaking so delicious. Yeah, everything. I mean, he knocks it out of the park. They do wonderful work. He hires the right people. He talks about how he hires people smarter than him, which, like, is everybody. But, see, I get the last word. Just kidding, Jay.
Harsh.
Of course, he's clearly very bright. But not as bright as the people, his lackeys that work for him, who are doing amazing microbiology stuff and kind of getting everything together. They're doing all the right things. It's beautiful, consistent, and he's a great host. I strongly recommend anybody interested in sour beer or producing sour beer to check out the Sour Hour. He's 57 episodes in, and each one is just packed full of intriguing, inspiring information and stories told by my favorite sour makers and the awesome people. I'm inspired as a brewer and as a human being. Thank you, Jay Goodwin. Thank you, Brewing Network.
And I'm going to say, next time we're in the Bay Area, we're going, because the tasting room is in Berkeley. It's open Thursday through Sunday, and there's a food menu and everything. So
if you're in Berkeley, go check it out. Yes. And if you're not in Berkeley, go over to Berkeley and go check it out.
Yes. Anyway.
That's right.
Man, we have to make a visit out
there.
It's
true.
Anyway, we'll leave you with that. Next week is Memorial Day weekend. I believe we are going to play a very special show that we recorded over the break. So tune in for that.
Ferment About It. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.